Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Project U Radio. I guess I'm your host, or one of your hosts, Frankie Metro, of course. Tonight we are interviewing Mr. Timothy Murray. You guys may actually be familiar with him as the Red Fez radio host sporadically. And he's got some good stuff coming out, actually. A new book recently released by Citizens for Decent Literature Press. Dinosaur Ditch. Really good stuff. Great stuff, actually. That being said, I'm going to turn this over, actually, to the regular hosts, Project U Radio, Ms. Lynn Alexander and Mr. Paul Coleman Roberts. Welcome, guys.
Hi.
Thank you. What's going on?
Ah, no problem. No problem at all.
Having pretty nasty storms out here. Sorry.
That's all good. We're glad you're not electrocuted. That's all.
I know. It's been crazy. We have trees down. We have power lines. It's crazy. And I thought it was okay, and we were out of the woods. But yeah, it's back to suck. Sorry. Yeah. So good evening.
Do you still have those power lines slipping outside your window?
Yes, I do, and it's scaring the hell out of me. Yeah, it's intense, but.
Hopefully
it's over. So it's all good, and I do appreciate you guys. Getting in there like that.
Yeah, no problem. That's what we're all here for.
Thank you for the last minute backup, Frankie. That's huge.
No problem, man. I always got you guys back. Always.
You do. More than once we've had this, we've had all kinds of situations. I remember the situations with the file. I was like, if only I could, summon Frankie, And there you were. It was like, oh, you saved my ass. Thank you. So, yeah.
Sometimes
Thank
I have
you.
Spider sense. That's so. We're also joined by Mr. Timothy Murray and Ms. Michelle McDonald. Welcome, both of you.
Good evening.
Hello.
Good evening.
And hello. Tim Murray. Hello. Yeah.
Having me on the show.
Hello, Tim Murray. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much for having me on the show tonight.
Well, it's wonderful to have you guys. And, we have a lot to talk about because we've got books to talk about. We've got press business to talk about. But, one of the things is that, I wanted to congratulate you first right off the bat because, Dinosaur Ditch is a pretty cool read. I actually reread it, so that I could, be fluent a little bit in case, we discussed some of it a little bit. But, no, I think it's an excellent work that you guys did. And Michelle, for putting it together, she did a hell of a job, so... Yeah,
well, thank you very much, Lynn Alexander, and I'm actually going to have to take your word for it because I haven't read it yet.
You have a copy of it, though, right? Do you have a copy on your coffee table?
That's where the distribution arm of Citizens for Decent Literature has been lagging behind a little bit, but I have it on good authority, Mr. Murray, that situation is under control, and that your author's stipend is on its way tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, I went over and checked the PO box today because I knew I was going to be on the radio tonight, and I thought, well, I'm just going to fetch my copies out of there. But I had nothing but those credit card advertisements or whatever they are.
Circular.
Refinance your life today and all that kind of stuff.
Nothing
offers
good.
To gamble.
Yeah. love letters from Frankie Metropolis.
Well, we don't get those, or maybe I just don't get those. I can't speak for everyone, but I don't get those. I think
that's a strange
that a
irony.
Bit.
We were able to bone up on our dinosaur dish, but you were not able to.
You guys could read me a selection.
Well, we could do that, sir, if it comes down to that. But you know what? Why don't I describe it a little bit, since I have it in my hand and you don't, so that you can sort of grope it vicariously through us, because you do
yes,
not have
wonderful.
Your copy. But you know, the thing is that, and Michelle can speak to a little, you know, a little more obviously about her process. But you know, she did put these together lovingly, and I know it was a time consuming kind of process, because you know, Michelle is old school. She likes to do things. So like, old school is kind of code for when you like to do things the hard way. And
yeah,
you know, she actually hand screen printed the covers. So you know, when you kind of run your hand on the cover of Dinosaur Ditch, it's actually raised a little bit, so it gives it sort of a, you know, a texture, like a tactile. Your book is a tactile experience, Murray. So when you get it, you can run your fingers and yeah, it's across your fingers. Yeah.
Is that how you bone up on your Dinosaur Ditch? This is starting to sound dirty.
Yeah. Paul Foreman Robert, has a book ever made you horny?
No, never.
Okay,
never.
Thank you.
Not at all, not even Uncle Bobo. This book made me hot. This was actually the first, Dinosaur Ditch was the first book to ever like make me hot. Like, you know, like stroke myself hot.
Wait a minute. This was the first book to ever make you hot. Is that what you're saying on the record?
Wow.
On the record publicly? I did say that. That doesn't mean it's true. But yes, I am saying that publicly on the record.
Your bone folder out, man. Freaking sales are going through the roof. Get that bone folder out. Get that stapler warmed up.
Yeah. Take a few practice snaps. Yeah, that's right.
Do you own a bone folder, Tim Murray?
You know, I'm going to plead the fifth on that.
I kind of feel like you're
delving into my personal bedroom life by asking me about bone folders in the small press. It has been suggested to me to invest in a bone folder in Milwaukee, Wisconsin earlier this year. But I have the, let me just say this. I do not own a bone folder because I have the delicate hands of Michael Grover at my disposal.
Oh, okay. So are you saying his hands are sort of like having a bone folder?
They are. Feminine. I mean, they're rugged on the one side. They're
on the hairy side,
like the brawny. Yeah, on the hairy
side.
Yeah,
the back side. The back side is the hairy side.
No, the palm side, and it's kind of like the brawny. You know, kind of like that brawny lumberjack paper towel guy. You know, you think it's this ruggedness, but he's really this comforting man. You know, with very soft hands and very, very gentle. And he folded.
His
eyes are like an ocean. You can go less swimming
Dinosaur Ditch. Yeah, I don't want to get off the subject of Dinosaur Ditch. But earlier this year, I self-published the "I'm This Robot" chapbook, and Michael Grover was instrumental in getting that on the street and in the mail. MALE.
Right. Well, I thought that a discussion about your artistic implements was relevant to the DIY point of view of this book, but I did not mean to offend and intrude into your personal, your personal effect in the bedroom. I apologize for that.
You have to realize, Lynn, that for some authors, DIY and self-publishing is very closely tied to their intimate lives. I think. That's where poets really break it in. The actual crafting and stapling of manuscripts together is like foreplay, I think, for a lot of writers.
Thank you, Paul Corman Roberts. That's wonderfully said.
and the selection of fine manly hands, you know, when you, yeah. I think that hands and having that poetic touch is very important. And I'm very glad that Michael Grover was able to provide that for you in the absence of, you know, owning your own bone folder. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
We can get you one.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I hope he knows that you appreciate him. You might want to send him, like, a thoughtful card from Hallmark.
No, let's just say that he didn't leave Milwaukee without knowing I appreciated him.
He left with full knowledge of the scope and depth of your appreciation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's good to know. That's good to know. I think we should tell you a little bit about the font, since you have not seen this book. I'd like Michelle, actually, when she wants to jump in, to maybe talk a little bit about the font. But, you know, it's pretty cool. It's, it's sort of like I kind of call it messed up printer typewriter font. But she could be more specific.
No, it's actually,
and then,
the whole book is actually Wingdings.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay, the whole thing. So we're looking at symbolic acemics here. What could you identify the animal that is posturing on the front in blue? Do you recall?
I'd like to leave that up to Michelle McDaniel.
Okay.
Michelle,
are you over there?
Yeah, that is the woolly mammoth there, Tim, that you requested, and I have answered the question to my kids 500 times now that, yes, I do know that is not a dinosaur.
But dinosaurs are not very woolly.
And my only answer is, you know, well, it's Tim Murray. I don't know what to tell you, kids.
do you associate him with the woolly mammoth?
What's the difference?
Why?
I don't understand.
Is it an Indiana thing?
No, I don't know anything about it. I don't. I requested a woolly mammoth. I requested a woolly mammoth on there. Michelle McDaniel came up with this woolly mammoth. Well, she has artists at her disposal who work very cheap. And,
she does.
They were able to come up with this cover picture, and I was very pleased with it. I did not know. I thought, you know, I can't differentiate between humans and dinosaurs or woolly mammoth. What would the plural be of woolly mammoths?
Mammoths, yeah, I think.
Mammoths? I don't
know
the difference between it.
Well, Dinosaur Ditch seems to be a place that you wrote about in the book, a place that you hung out with some childhood friends, like a kind of a play area. What's the story? Why did you call it Dinosaur Ditch?
Well, we kind of inherited that name from, I had an uncle who was only about 6 or 7 years older than me, so everybody always thought I was his kid brother tagging along with him, you know, to these places
right.
in the neighborhood where they would play. And they always referred to this place as Dinosaur Ditch. And what it was kind of this sandy area. I guess it was an offshoot of the Indiana Dunes at one time or another. But it had this ravine that had been dug into it. Somehow maybe a giant tree had fallen over, and there were these huge oak trees growing in it. And I know we just used to play in the trees. It was kind of the time of Return of the Jedi came out, and we kind of had these X-Wing fighters up in the trees and things like that. And around 1985 or 6, I believe, and we kind of had our favorite tree limbs and these things. We were about 10 years old or so, and just kind of inherited this name, Dinosaur Ditch, but it fit. But the strange thing is, I've gone back that way. In the 90s sometime when I was in high school, the land was murdered by bulldozers and that, and they ended up putting one of those prefab houses up on the land. And it's amazing now when I go back there because it's so, the actual area is so damn small. It's this little corner parcel in the middle of a neighborhood now, and it's amazing how small it was now, but to our imaginations as kids, you know, it was fucking Return of the Jedi, you know, and we didn't know any
right,
better.
Right, right. It was larger than life. It really was larger
than life.
Yeah, it
was, absolutely. We didn't bother about the houses that were around or anything now, but as an adult, it's pretty amazing how small the place was. And then kind of getting more of the book, you know, my the title track in the chat book, Dinosaur Ditch, was the centered around the death of a friend of mine who was one of those kids up in the trees with the X-Wing fighter in the mid-80s, and I hadn't seen him, hadn't really been friends with him since maybe junior high, and certainly hadn't seen him since high school. And then my brother just rings up one afternoon and tells me that he had passed away, and I'm thinking, shit, you know, this, we're, you know, 33 years old or 35 or however the hell old we were at the time, and but damn, you know, he's got kids and stuff, he's got a son as young as we once were, you know, and I think,
yeah.
He was in the military at the time, and I thought he'd been killed in Iraq or something, because I knew that he was kind of following the small-town newspapers, and, you know, who's in, serving in the military and whatnot, and I thought, damn, maybe he'd got blown up in Iraq or something, and he'd actually been down in Missouri on maneuvers to be sent back for, like, his umpteenth tour of Iraq or something, and of all things, to kill him was a damn tick, you know. It was really amazing.
Right, that's as much a casualty of the war, though, as somebody who steps on an IED, though, in a lot
yeah.
of ways. If it wasn't for the damn war, he wouldn't have been down there on maneuvers, you know.
Right, absolutely. And, I mean, he was a... I mean, maybe our political philosophies were totally different as adults, but, man, I was...
Well,
it just brought me around to this thing about my own mortality, you know, and I'm thinking, well, shit, you know, if guys that I would, you know, spent the night at their houses and played Atari with are dying, you know, what does that mean for me? And that's kind of where the whole thing was born.
Yeah, I've had this conversation with other poets. I think Lynn, one of them, like my dad just reads the obituaries now, looking for people that he knows. He has this kind of morbid fascination with it because I think it's that same sort of, I think he gets that same sort of profound effect that you're talking about, you know,
yeah.
when that happens. And, you know, and I think for him, you know, just, I think his mortality has become sort of his version of a cheap thrill as he's gotten older.
Right,
but
I've
think
fucking
outlived
him. Right. Here's another one.
Right. That I live them, or just like, wow, there goes another set of memories into the ether, you know, in a way.
Yeah.
You know, and you're kind of in awe of the impermanence of it all.
Absolutely. And then even the land, you know, where it actually physically happened has been plowed over, and we can never go back to this, you know, this
right.
innocent
right.
place with a tire swing or whatever, you know.
Right, talk about impermanence. This thing that was bigger than a galaxy at one time is you know, just sort of reduced to size. I had that experience at Disneyland. I went back to Disneyland a couple of years ago, not for me, but for my daughter. But you know, it had been over 30 years since I'd been there, and I was just walking around going, God, you know what? Yeah, a lot of this is really familiar. I kind of remember all this stuff, but man, the place is like 10 times smaller than I remember it being.
Yeah, I remember when that happened to my grandparents' hallway in their house, you know, where it was like, you know, action figure city or whatever when you were a kid, and then you just wake up one day and you're 17 and you're like, shit, this is like 6 feet long or something, you know? It's like,
yeah.
What's going on here?
Really, how was this ever the path back to the engine room? I don't understand.
Yeah, right.
So you know, I mean, really, so you've sort of taken, I mean, the mortality issue and, you know, on a certain level kind of applied it, you know, back onto this play space, this, you know, this patch of land that, you know, is no longer there either. I mean, it really is sort of that impermanence, that sort of transient nature of things and us. I mean, you kind of came full circle with it in this, you know, collection of work, you know. I think no. I think I mean
this
actually,
chapbook.
It was pretty cool. I really liked it a lot. And you know, I mean, I have to say, like, I'm sort of like man picky with things like this. I mean, you know, for me to really feel moved and you know, I mean, I think you did an excellent job. And I really hope that people get their hands on it. And a little bit later, we'll certainly mention how people can do that and
yeah,
process for doing that. because I'd really like, I mean, and I think Michelle, you know, would say the same thing. We, you know, the whole thing with wanting to get this out there, you know, to as many people as we can and spread it around. And, you know, that's what the whole, you know, that's the difference between a chat book and, you know, a perfectly bound, glossy, $30 volume is. I mean, a chapbook is really, you know, by tradition and design, meant to be something that you can share, that you can trade, that you, you know, you have love behind. You know, it's a sharing instrument. So, you know, that's sort of the spirit behind it, putting this together.
Thank you very
what
much
do you
for
think
that,
about
Lynn.
That, Michelle?
Yeah, go ahead, Michelle.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, I'm cutting you off. I'm sorry. I just thought she might have something to say about the spirit of,
because
she did this. She worked so hard.
I certainly fell in love with the book time and time again. I mean, just reading it the first time, I was pretty blown away. I mean, I've always liked Tim's work, but some of it is, you know, a little bit out there, and this, I don't know, I connected to. And then going through the process of figuring out how to make the book and what to do with the cover, and it was just a very fulfilling experience on my end, and I would love for people to read it because it's very good work, and I'm happy with the way it turned out.
Can I read something from it, actually?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, this is actually the first part. This is part one, and this is it's immediately struck out to me about the book, and I love this poem to death. Part one, Dinosaur Ditch by Tim Murray. Through blind birth luck, I live in Indiana, frozen crossroads of the American conundrum, under the legalized gusts of steel mill exhaust, where the mercury-laced waters of Lake Michigan lap in the north, where vinyl nightmare houses replace crops and fields, where boys spend summers pissing from trees in Dinosaur Ditch, where grandma's kitchen skillet first received its golden commandment from heaven, where daddy walked the brief, brawling streets of youth, where Miss Burton offered phantom treats from Halloween tray of neighborhood lore, where Mr. Berkeley sat with coke plant emphysema cough, where Red Cunningham lost his arm to the alligator machinery of industry, where summer lasts for 2 hours in July, then returns to comforting gray, chilled skies, where Tina snuffed out at 19, stabbed and discarded like a sack of trash, still no suspects in sight, where teens crack garage doors to vent afternoon bong coughs, where there's a church and a bar on every corner espousing liquid heaven escape, where I often think of myself blessed and trapped, third generation familiar with the sounds of these bleeding streets, its inhabitants' vision, dreams, changes, bursting with a tragic, fragile, and hopeful rebirth. Fucking love that poem. What really stuck out to me, man, was like... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No, go ahead, Frankie. Take it away.
No, I was just going to say, like, what really stuck out to me about it was it felt like an introduction to, like, I don't know, what I consider to be, like, the American Black Heart, Northwest Indiana, which is a place that's riddled with smokestacks, pollution, and, you know, almost an unredeemable and unapologetic existence. In the same state...
Gary.
In the same breath, what I really dig about this, he's, like, in the same breath, man, you find, like, family relics, you find boyhood candor... I think, like, the key transitional point of the poem is located in, I don't know, like, what I like to consider, like, vinyl-coated, mechanized blood of factory workers, fathers with bald fists and whatnot. It's a beautiful fucking poem, man.
Thanks, Frank. I think you hit the nail on the head with that, too, because you catch the drift of it. Because, actually, the people in, everybody in that thing, Red Cunningham, I actually didn't know whether to use people's real names and stuff because, you know, these are actual people from my neighborhood. I grew up in a, you know, it's really blue collar. It was Lake Station, Indiana. It's one of those, it used to be called East Gary, where we had to make sure that we weren't being confused with that, with all those niggers in actual Gary, you know. We had to make sure that we broke off from that and renamed it Lake Station sometime in the 70s, you know. Because
helps the real estate, helps the real estate values, right?
Yeah, right. And it was this, you know, it was this blue collar like bedroom community. I mean, there was absolutely nothing there but neighborhoods, because all the guys went off to work in the mills and on the railroads all day. And that was, you know, both of my grandfathers, my own father, all of my uncles, and everybody I ever knew. And then, you know, I was told from the youngest age, you know, you're supposed to, you know, go to the mill at 18 or 19 and get your first car and all that kind of stuff, you know, and do all this kind of bullshit. And I watched all these people around me fucking miserable and most of them alcoholics and violent bastards, and Red Cunningham is an actual person. He's still alive, actually. He's probably about 70 now, and he actually had his arm gnawed off in one of these places, and he was that scary guy in the neighborhood who, you know, who always had the nub of an arm walking around, you know.
Jesus Christ.
So he's still around somewhere, but Mr. Berkeley was a guy who worked in the coke plants of U.S. Steel, and he had a lot of those guys who worked in that environment is so polluted that they wound up with really bad emphysema, and he used to sit out on his front porch with an oxygen tank and stuff, and that's really this thing, you know, at 10 years old or whatever, walking past there and seeing that every day, and seeing my own family members miserable as fuck, you know. I tried my hand at it, you know. I've had my tour of duty in U.S. Steel, and I just, you know, I can't hack it, you know. It's just not that place where, I don't know, man, it's a dying thing, you know. It's like we can plow over U.S. Steel tomorrow and that land would be uninhabitable for centuries, you know. It's just absolutely destroyed the environment, you know, and everything about it, from lead to asbestos to mercury or you name it, and
chromium, PCBs, all that stuff.
Yeah, you name it. Yeah, and they come home with your clothes covered in the shit, you know, bring it home to the kids and roll around the living room floor with them, you know. Yeah. And who else is mentioned in there? Tina is actually, I didn't use her last name because the murder is still unsolved. I guess I should have to maybe publicize it a little bit, but she was a couple years older than me. And, you know, she got caught up in the drug scene and things like that. It's like my generation, you know, it's like, oh, we're not going to fucking be as miserable as our dads were, so we're just going to sit around and smoke pot in garages all day. And she got up in that trip, you know, and wound up murdered in Lake Station in summer of 94. It's still an unsolved murder, and I guess I should have used her last name. Her name was Tina Wilkerson, and I was really good friends with her younger brother, but, you know, I hung out with her a lot, and it's one of those unsolved things, I guess. It's just part of that small-town story that has to be told, you know, and she's just another one of those ghosts on the brief brawling streets or whatever.
Crazy.
I guess I'm done now.
I mean, I'm glad that you got into sort of the industrial, you know, flavor and tone. I mean, I'm glad that you brought that into it because it isn't, I mean, it's more than sort of a recollection. I mean, it really is a little bit of a study of, you know, what a lot of people consider to be sort of like, you know, it sort of speaks to me a little bit because now I'm living outside of Pittsburgh, and outside of Pittsburgh is very much the same way. It's mills. It's the mill lifestyle. You know, the guys, you know, grew up and they went to work in the mill, and, you know, now they have black lung and they're fighting to keep their pensions from the steel companies, and they're, you know, union guys, and, you know, I recognize a lot of that. The time that I've been out here now, I've been out here long enough to, you know, sort of, you know, get that sense of, you know, of the place and, you know, just sort of that, you know, the expectation and that people do, you know, there is that hope that you don't, I mean, I don't want to say that you don't end up like your dad or your parents, but you sort of come away from what I see wanting more, wanting to kind of get out of here a little bit. And yeah, they're plowed under, they're polluted, and it's like they're these like ghost plants now, you know, and people here now don't have jobs, and it's sort of depressed, and it's sort of, like I said, I recognized a lot of that element in here, and I'm kind of, you know, I think it's kind of an interesting thing to bring into your experience and to sort of share that, you know, from where you live, that regional distinction, because, you know, you don't get that growing up where I grew up, you know, that's a whole new world, but now that I live out here, you know, I see it, and I think, wow, he's really nailed it from what I've observed, you know, here with people that are similar industries, that industrial, you know, kind of working class, you know, situation.
Yeah, I wasn't this destitute. What the hell is that? Paul!
I don't know.
But anyhow, I mean, I didn't want to convey this phony image at all in these poems about, you know, some being some kind of destitute street kid or something like that, because like I said, when I was a kid, you know, the mills were booming and everything, and, you know, we had a color TV and Atari and all that shit, you know. I didn't grow up as some rotten street kid or something like that, you know, but my generation, though, inherited this, you know, this oh, what the hell, you know, this kind of decentralized and destroyed industrial center of the United States with this outsourcing and computerization of everything. And we in, you know, my generation, X or whatever the hell you call it, was, you know, inherited this $8 an hour service industry economy of this area where for the last 100 years it had been good paying union jobs. Now it's like, you know, you want Buffalo Wild Wings or, you know, you want to go work at Applebee's or what do you want to do, man?
Right, or Dollar General.
Sure, we got it, man.
Right.
$8 an hour,
right.
Are you kidding me? They pay that much? You know, come on.
That's good living.
Yeah, it's good living.
Right. And like I said, a lot of these guys are fighting for what was promised to them. They're people that, you know, gave basically their entire adult lives to these mills and these plants. Retired, and now they're fighting just to keep, you know, their pensions, and, you know, it's sad because, yeah, it's the same here. It's sort of this, you know, the bleed of jobs to other places, and you really see it. You see these people, they're out of work, and, you know, they don't have that security. They don't have, you know, I don't want to go on a tear about unions and you know, jobs and things, but, you know, yeah, people here, it's like, well, you have Walmart, you have the Dollar General, you have, you know, the auto parts store, and, you know,
That's absolutely right.
But they're not... They're not jobs that, you know, you can raise a family on. You know, they're jobs where you need two or three.
No.
Right. You need two or three of those jobs, you know, to survive. And I think that's very much the experience in America right now for a lot of people. That's sort of the underside of, you know, the years of what we've been doing. You know, and I mean, I like that there were, I mean, you didn't really, like, you didn't beat it over the head, you know, it wasn't a political book, it wasn't a book about economics, but, you know, certainly that experience and those observations, I think, really came through in very subtle ways, you know, you see little bits and pieces of that experience, and, you know, it was sort of a good balance of a lot of different things, you know, nostalgia, And I think being, you know, our generation, obviously, you know, also being the Atari generation, the generation that didn't have internet and had that sort of come about during our, you know, our years,
getting
older.
I think that's a great point. Look at how many things have changed.
Yeah, so sure. I think it speaks to everyone, but I think, like, our generation, you know, this really, in just a couple of pages, I mean, my gosh, it's only, what is it, 15 pages long. And yet it has so much in it that people, our generation, can relate to from their childhood, from dirt bomb fights, from Star Wars, you know. We all kind of had our dinosaur ditch in our own neighborhood in our own way. Yeah.
Oh,
so
yeah.
That's what got to me.
That's a great point, Lynn. Thank you. That's a great point. I actually kind of wasn't thinking about the bigger picture. Like, man, this shit exists in pockets all over the United States, you know, especially in the Midwest with these little Rust Belt communities and things like that. You know, there was a damn dinosaur ditch in everyone's neighborhood, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Right. I mean, yeah, that was where we had our dirt bike. Like I said, you know, that's where you took apart a dirt bike, and that's where, you know, you know what it was? It was the oasis away from the adult problem. It was that pocket, that place where, you know, you know, where childhood was sort of intact, where you didn't have to hear, you know, the neighbors complaining and the people, you know, you didn't have to see the ugly part of adulthood. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, like, I kind of got that about, you know, it's sort of almost like an oasis that isn't there anymore. You know, you can't go back to that innocent childhood time, you know.
Now I'm the guy that they're trying to get away from and go hide down in their dinosaur ditch, you know, and I'm hammering the kitchen table over the damn electric bill or something, you know.
Right. I mean, you get older, and like you mentioned,
the adult problems
too.
Always wind up finding all the hideouts. That's just the cruel reality of it.
And there's a loss of innocence, like, you know, like I said, about the murder and about, you know, when you start to get older and you realize, you know, people around you, you know, your mortality, you know, that's really when I think, like, the innocence goes out the window, you know, when you have somebody that, you know, you used to play with, you know, Star Wars action figures, and now they're gone, tragically, you know, I think it really hits that point home of, you know, not only am I going to age and, you know, go through the rituals of being an adult and the expectations, but, you know, wow, people, you know, I could you know, this could be it. You know, and it really, it's you know, to think about, like I said, in 15 pages, I mean, that's what amazes me, is I'm like, he put so much stuff into such a, you know, a relatively short collection, really. You know, it's just loaded with stuff, so.
That's what I kind of tried to say in, I think, the Ballad of Blabbering Eddie, you know, it's kind of, I woke up one day and I was 30, and I've, you know, asking myself, you know, how did I get here? Why did I get here? And what the hell do I do now? You know, like what the hell are we supposed to do? Shit!
This is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful wife.
How did I get here? Oh my lord!
Right.
Well,
I didn't sign up for this. You know, nobody asked me.
And it sucks too. A lot of it. You know.
Yeah.
The other thing is, not only how did I get here, and how did I wake up 30? Well, I'm way past 30. I'm almost 40. But, you know, it's like, and this isn't that great. This is work. This is bills. This is hard. This sucks, you know, in a lot of ways. I mean, in a lot of ways, there's a lot of joy and wonderful things with our families. But, you know, it's not easy, you know. It's like,
no.
You almost wish you could go back, you know, to go back to
I think that segues nicely into this other poem that kind of stands out, because it's funny. There's a lot of you have a lot of characters, you know, for a little short chap. I'm impressed with the wide range of characters that you have throughout it, and almost like a cast from a play, if you will. But then there's this really unique poem, towards the end called "A Unicycle Built for Two," which is my favorite in the entire collection.
Is it really?
Which starts
your
favorite? I have to say, you know, and it's really weird because I like the way how at the end it becomes a play, and it's this dialogue between two people, and this dialogue that goes back and forth, and I can totally see it happening on a stage, which is kind of appropriate given that you've been known to have you have thespian like tendencies that run in your blood, I believe, from the thespian. Yes, thespian is the correct word I was looking for there. I wasn't sure if those were legal in Indiana or not, but yes, thespians are legal in Indiana.
Are there thespians in Indiana?
I don't know. I don't even know what that other word is. I just don't. But I found that interesting, that somebody who's got a background and works in, you know, the dramatic medium had, you know, in this one particular poem. I mean, do you think there was some influence there? I mean, do you think your involvement with theater kind of helped this sort of help that poem go from this sort of thoughtful meditation in the beginning, and then it kind of wraps around into this whirlwind of dialogue that's like from a play? And I'm just kind of wondering how that worked for you, how you did that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm really tuned into all these Red Cunningham type characters. You know, if I pass them or meet them once or something like that, I'll never forget the idea that they exist. You know, I don't want to talk about some guy sitting on a bar stool. We had this guy in town who would pull not too long ago, maybe 5 or 10 years ago, and he'd pull this red radio flyer wagon around with him every day, and he was about 40 or 45 years old, with shirtless, completely sunburned all the time, and he would stand out front of the Burger King like giving Nazi salutes and stuff. You know, I don't know if the elevator went all the way up to the top floor or not, or what his deal was, but I'm like, gosh, this really like a personal hero. And I know he wasn't out there politically giving any Nazi salutes, you know. This was just something, some kind of impulse he had to go do this thing. Shock theater, you know, like guerrilla theater or something. And if you think about
the absurdity
of opening the fucking mailbox in the morning or something, you know, and thinking about the absurd, you know, like kind of the first act that opens for the day unfolds, you know.
That mailbox lid is like a curtain.
Yeah.
It's like a curtain coming down.
Sure. Now the curtain's up, and hey, look at this. We have an improv to do now. You know, we're going to play this juggling act on stage, and it's going to be all improv, and what are we going to do with it now? And so, yeah, I think the idea of sitting on the toilet or sharing the bathroom with your spouse or loved one or girlfriend or whoever she happens to be, your boyfriend, I don't know, sharing your, you know, your toilet and your room with these people, your living space, and, of course, it's going to be this dialogue. I mean, we're engaged in it every single day. We just have to tap into the awareness of it, man. I'm kind of using that left coast lingo to get to you, Paul Corman Roberts. You know, it's kind of like tap into the, you know, the awareness of it.
the flow of it, the chi.
Yeah. Sorry.
You got great chi, Tim Murray. You have fucking fabulous chi, let me just say.
I don't know what that means,
he
man, but I got a Dr.
Holder.
Pepper here, and I'm happy.
Ask JD. JD knows. JD knows what chi is. I'm sure he does.
Oh, I'm sure he does. But I think that's funny that you say that about, because when I read that particular piece, you know, there's that point where it says when the door suddenly swings open, and you know, the action aspect of it. I mean, yeah, it is sort of like at that point it goes, it sort of transitions, and it does become almost like, you know, the opening of a curtain and becomes almost like, you know, theater-like, you know, like dialogue. You know, it does change, and I kind of thought that with that particular one, too. You know, that it sort of moves away off the page into something that you can easily visualize, you know, being like two actors going back and forth with this, you know. And I think it would work well even to perform it that way, too. But, yeah, I think it kind of moves into, other than the incapacitated on the toilet bar, that might be hard to pull off. But.
We're not going to fictionalize this. If we're going to do it, man, somebody's going to be with their pants around their ankles, you know. Sitting on the floor. That's the reality of it, my friend.
Well, you know what? We've had a lot of people that have, you know, sort of have proven the chops to do that. Paul, Steve Goldberg, you know, people that have proven their talents for removing their pants for the sake of art, on the stage.
Hey, does Brian actually use toilets?
No. He doesn't need to. He's wearing Depends. So he's got the toilet built in right to the garment. It would be redundant for him to be on a toilet, you know. It's sort of like he's already got that covered. He can void abandon.
Well, by not having to go to the bathroom, he actually gains more drinking time. That's his strategy there.
Right. He could drive all the way to Florida without having to stop.
That's right. That's the
Yeah.
It's one of those long train trips.
The long train trip. Well, you could definitely catch this. I'm sure.
I could almost see Brian hitching rails, jumping boxcars when he's an old man, almost.
Right. Just sort
hopefully, and his poor daughter Hannah chasing him around the country, saying, "Dad, come home."
It'd be like Jan Kerouac or something.
I think we should put, I don't know if it's putting you on the spot. I mean, I'm sure you expect that we're going to do this because, you know, but what if you read something of your choice from the book that you don't own? Do you have a copy of it or do you need us to do it like by proxy? I mean,
allow me to open up the Word document here.
Okay.
And that's the only copy of this book I
always at the fingertips of a professional poet, for sure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Right. I love when they do that at reading, when people do that. Well, let me open up the Word doc. Oh, wait, where did I put that? Where did I save that?
I think I saw somebody reading from their iPhone one.
Wait. It's in the wrong folder. Sorry.
Yeah.
2 minutes of your 5 minutes are up already.
Oh, I have it open. What should I read?
How about you choose, or, you know, we could choose for you, but, yeah.
Well, I don't know. Let's see here. You know. I don't know.
I like the Ballad of Uncle Bobo. I know that's a little bit longer, but I kind of like Ballad of Uncle Bobo.
Yeah.
The Ballad of Uncle Bobo?
That's the Ballad of...
Bobo, is that you back there?
I was going to say the Ballad of Blabbering Eddie, but I like the Ballad of Uncle Bobo, too, so go with that.
All right. Well
then, actually, what we just did
Bobo.
Was provided the chatter. It starts with family chatter, so that's what we're trying to provide here. So.
Oh, okay,
All right. So you're comfortable.
Well, to kick it off, let's just say that Bobo is actually a compendium of people that I've known or have been related to. He's not a singular person here.
Interesting.
Yeah,
he's
a small town World War II veteran that every family has tucked away somewhere.
Yeah.
And they're dying off at an enormously rapid rate, you know, like we're gonna lose more now than they actually did on the battlefields of, you know, both theaters of World War II or whatever the hell. But here's the thing. The Ballad of Uncle Bobo. Prelude. Family chatter heard from adjoining room. Uncle Bobo ate all the licorice again. Why does everyone look bitchin' when tagged in Facebook party pictures? I was wondering that after the Zyfez Oakland. Why does everybody look bitchin' when tagged in Facebook party pictures? Anyhow, we were all having a blast. You should have been there. She strolls through various photographs like a Mamie Van Doren hag coughing up a leather feather boa constrictor. Uncle Bobo, 86 years old, sits in big comfy chair with 7-Up and gin on rocks. Puffs one stogie a day for general health benefits. Been doing that since around 1942. Can't hear so well nowadays. Motions me near with a wave of the hand. You've practically got to squat over the top of him to hear the faint rasp of voice delivered through a mouth devoid of teeth or dentures. Uncle Bobo gets winded easily in conversation. Must take several breaks to sip from glass, light puff of blue-tinged smoke, he continues. Uncle Bobo says there ain't ever been any war that was civil, no matter what them talking head expert types on cable TV documentaries say. Nope, ain't nothing civil about having your innards scrambled by a bayonet or your head sent airmail by way of cannonball. Uncle Bobo says he feels dang sorry for them boys in Vietnam who were mutilated. Says back then he could never figure out why in heck our government had such a fetish for stuffing body bags with youthful national resources. Uncle Bobo says things were different for him and his generation. He says in his day evil had a face, and that face had a rising sun in the east and a funny little mustache in the west, and everybody damn well knew which side they were on, and it was easy to know who, what, why, when, and where the fighting and dying was going to take place. Uncle Bobo is confused by the modern hostile geopolitical atmosphere. He remembers 1943 as if it happened this afternoon, but has no idea who the current president is, and cannot recall why or what our forces are doing in Iraq or Afghanistan. You don't have to be 86 years old for that, actually. Instead, he chews on Three Musketeer candy bars because he says they're easy on his gums. He takes several sudden naps a day where he will doze in the middle of a sentence. Family members are in constant fear of Uncle Bobo nodding off with a lit cigar in his jaw. He's done it numerous times, as can be seen by the crispy brown rings on the carpet around his chair. Fortunately, he hasn't burned the house to the ground yet, or charred himself in his recliner. I've got to scroll. Hold on, guys. The sun... I wish we could invent a, an actual hard copy chapbook that you'd have to scroll somehow. The sun sets early during a Hoosier winter. The inviting smell of a feel-good dinner wafts from the kitchen. A muted television flashes in the corner of the living room to the tune of Uncle Bobo's snores. He's flopped with chair reclined, head tilted back, mouth agape, one slipper having fallen to the floor, exposing a gnarled, pale-as-chalk left foot with wild yellow nail growth and stogie dutifully smoldering in the ashtray. That's the ballad of Uncle Bobo, ladies and gentlemen.
It's a beautiful poem, man.
Thank
beautiful.
You. Oh, I like that guy.
I'm snapping my fingers. Like a hipster.
He's cranky. He makes me want a cigar. I actually want to smoke a cigar right now.
You smoke cigars, Paul Corman Roberts?
Not regularly, no.
We did out there in Berkeley.
I didn't have one. We had
some from Brian out there.
I know. You kept trying to get me to take one. You wanted me to have a cigar, but I was just like,
they
no,
were
no.
Fine. They were fine cigars.
It was three in the morning. We were out of our heads. We were all out of our heads.
But you know what, Paul Corman Roberts, you guys may have been out of your heads, but you look damn good in the party pictures.
God. Well, thank you. That's a generous thing of you to say, Tim, because some of the shots make me wince a little bit, like, oh, that one got, oh, that one, oh, well, oh, that's, oh, but then I see one, but I notice the pictures that I have with Lynn are exponentially better than the ones that I don't appear with Lynn in, for sure.
Well, she takes the focus off of you, a little bit there.
She does. She takes the focus off of my old acne scars here and my salt and pepper beard, because I am a brother of the salt and pepper beard, and the wrinkles and the huge Samsonite suitcases underneath my eyelids or beneath my eyes. Like, oh, hey, look at everybody. Hey, take a look over here. Take a look here. Look at this bright, attractive woman, Lynn. She's let her shine.
I took that to mean the opposite. I thought you were saying that my old age and wrinkles made you look better in contrast. I thought it was where you were going.
That's not what you always hear. That's not what I said, but that's what you heard. So we can agree to agree
you're
that that's what I said and what I said
usual,
and what you heard.
That's every day with us. But no, I mean we did have a good time. I think you can kind of see that. But you know what? We missed you. I have to say that. You know,
yes.
we understood you couldn't be out there. You know, we can't all be everywhere. But you know, there was definitely a sense of wishing that you had, you know, that you were kind of around. And I think one of the things we want to try to do is, you know, have something that we can set up that's a little bit closer, more convenient, you know, to other people as well, you know, and maybe you can...
There was just that small list in the sails that was the good ship Zyphez. Just the wind wasn't quite as strong.
I think at a certain moment, we all looked at the sky, and we felt like we were in Indiana for a second.
Would a guy from Dinosaur Ditch, you know, would he even do good on the streets of Oakland or San Francisco or a place like that, you know?
I think given the festive environment and the supportive souls that we had coming together, you know, it's like my friend Javier told me, he says, what you're trying to do here is basically take all these bright, burning little particles and you're trying to compress them into one little space for one little moment at a time and see what comes out of that. And I have to say, you know what, you're kind of right. That is kind of what we're going for here. And, you know, you find if you step into that light and you step into that heat, it's not a bad thing, Tim. It's not a bad thing to do. I think you'd be amazed at the kind of ways that your eyes would open and the way and the connections you make. And I mean, I don't think I have to tell you. I think you already have an idea, actually.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
I get the sense that we could. It would have been good to have you out, and I think you know that we would have been glad to have you.
Absolutely, I know that, man. I really appreciate that too, because I was on some hard times here financially and stuff like that with the new service economy and the $8 an hour and all that, you know. And it was really thoughtful of Lynn. I want to thank you personally. I can thank you over this telephone line, but you know, you and Michelle were nice enough to send me some text and the messages on the Facebook and all that during the events, and it was really thoughtful to me. You know, really nice because to have that caring person on the other end, because I was really down and out, because I had plane tickets and all that stuff, you know, and it wasn't
that
like,
had to
you know,
be
I'd
so
paid,
hard.
Yeah, and I paid for my little spot in the compound and all that, and I was like, well, fuck, you know, I'm completely stuck here. I can't do anything about it, you know, and then to have those, you know, those little flickers of hope right there, and the friends like coming out and say, you know, we're thinking about you and how's everything doing, man. Just something as simple as that was really got me through some of those hard times. I'd like to thank you. And
well,
I feel kind of like we put Baby in the Corner with Michelle on the show tonight, and I would like to say that nobody puts Baby in the Corner.
No.
And I'd like Michelle to kind of talk about this a little bit with us here. I feel, you know, I don't want to stomp her voice out. Michelle, are you still awake?
I'm still here.
Okay.
You guys are doing good. I'm just letting you do your thing, you know.
All right. Sorry about that.
We want you to verbalize your thoughts, though, Michelle, because, you know, we don't get enough of that.
My thoughts? Oh, well, I really miss Timmy out there. I think he would have had a good time, and I hope that we get together soon.
We're going to do this thing. Right. You know, I can rock the Midwest like it's nobody's business. You know, I've been up to Milwaukee with you recently, and we just kind of sit around our little $5 a night house in Milwaukee, and we look down at the end of the table, you know, me and Frankie and his wife and the soft hands of Michael Grover, and we just kind of sit there and we look down at the end of the table And it's
the
like
landlord,
Mama says,
wasn't he there?
He was wonderful, yeah. And this landlord comes in, and he's wonderful, and he sits there, and he's... We weren't creeped out by him, but we were secretly. And we just looked down to the end of the table, man. It's like, Mama Fez, what do we do next, you know? It's like, wherever Mama Fez is going or whatever's going to happen, we're going to, you know, we're just going to follow that general vibe in that direction. And everything worked out well, even when Michael Grover was able to vaporize an actual street in Milwaukee and the city just folded in over this street we were looking for. And it skipped, you know, it was like, you know, 6th Street, 5th Street, 4th Street evaporated. You know, this Michael Grover type of Toledo, Ohio type of weird Collingwood haunting that was going on. I don't know what it was, but...
I think vaporize is the key word there, too, with Michael.
Yeah, and I had vaporize is a key word with Michael. And I had Mama Fez as my co-pilot, and that's what my bumper sticker says. You know, my co-pilot is Mama Fez. And I had her there as my co-pilot. And we navigated the streets of Milwaukee. And I believe we would have navigated the streets of the Bay Area. I believe one and all, brothers and sisters, that we would have navigated the streets of the Bay Area. I believe we would have crawled the beast that night, ladies and gentlemen. And I think everything would have been beautiful.
We would have joined hands.
We would have joined hands.
Melded minds.
So. I think we would have
melded
joined
minds.
Hands. And I think we would have had a few cigars, joined hands, and been just
We would
fine.
Have drank the Kool-Aid, man. We would have done it all, you know. I came home from Milwaukee with a spider leg from Frankie Metro, man. It was this kind of smorgasbord of Michael Grover and Frankie Metro into this one spider leg. And I came home with that. And it sat up on the shelf there, sat up on the bookshelf for a couple of days, you know, till I had that window of opportunity. And I took that spider leg. And I'll tell you, I inhaled that spider leg. And I didn't vote for Clinton. I inhaled that spider leg. That's right. I inhaled the entire thing in one standing. I didn't sit. And I wrote vast love letters, you know, that I'll never send to anyone, but they're written. And I
Oh my.
You write love
that's
letters
hard,
that
that's,
never
that's
send.
That's heartbreaking. That's sweet. No, that's you have to like publish them after your death or something. That's
yeah.
The most romantic way to handle that.
Yeah. I'll publish them. I'm going to come back with my bone folder one last time, you know. After I die, I'm going to come back with my bone folder, and I'm going to sit there, and I'm going to call up Michael Grover, and I'm going to call up Mama Fez, and those gentle hands are going to bone fold, and then I'm going to come on. Paul Corman Roberts and Lynn Alexander are going to be live from the Whispering Pines home on Blog Talk Radio, and we're going to have a reunion party.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I like
See,
that.
What the thing is? The thing is about these events, though, is that, you know, we get together and we do this stuff, but the thing is that, you know, it doesn't really end because, you know, we'll do it again, and we'll do it again, it's something that'll be repeated, you know, and that experience, you know, it's not something that you're sort of closing the door on, you know, And you'll make it. You'll make it out. We'll get you.
We'll get you.
We'll gas up the Howlmobile and we'll get you. Right, Michelle?
That's right.
Howlin'.
In the very least, you know, we have Zyfez coming up in November. It's going to be out in Albuquerque, and I'd really like to try to plan something for... 100,000 Poets Day.
Yes, yeah, 100,000 Poets in September.
Right, which we did. I did that with Tim last year, and it's an annual event, and I think it's a very important thing, you know, to take part in. It doesn't have to be something complicated. There are people that are doing picnics. There are people hanging out in the park. I mean, it doesn't have to be a big venue or a big, you know. You know, it's just really a coming together of people, you know, and you know, I think we can put something together. I think we're trying. I'm not sure where we're at with that, but it's in the works, so. Yeah.
Can I rewind for a minute here?
Yes,
of course.
Can I just rewind for a minute? I'd like to make a correction. Can you do that on live blog talk?
Yep. Okay.
Thank you.
You have 20 seconds.
All right, here's the thing. I'd like to correct the description I made of the Milwaukee table when I said Mama Fez was there, Soft Hands of Michael Grover, myself, Frankie Metro, and I said his wife. But I feel like I kind of voided out Lindsay Thomas by just simply referring to her as Frankie Metro's wife. While she is legally Frankie Metro's wife, the thing is, man, that gal stands in her own right, and I should have addressed her by name, because that gal is an artist in her own right, and she is funnier than all get out. She freaking counts her fingers all the time, man. 575 haiku, and she had this notebook with her up there. She spent the entire time, 2 days worth of counting her fingers the whole time.
She's
these 575 haiku things, and then she wound up losing the notebook on a bus in Albuquerque somewhere, you know. And she was,
I've done that. I've lost writings that I thought were like my brilliant breakthrough pieces, and I've left them on a bus. I can't. Like what? Sometimes that's the universe telling you that no, that was not your brilliant breakthrough piece.
Right. Yeah. That.
Well,
was
she also didn't she find a notebook once too, somewhere? I remember something about, you know, maybe it's sort of like it'll come back to her. Maybe someone will find it.
Yeah, I mean,
you never
Albuquerque,
know. You never know.
That's a small enough town, isn't it? There's about 500 people live there.
Hello. Few people live there.
I don't know about that.
I think it's a little bigger than that.
I don't know. I don't know. I've never, I don't, you know, I just like deserts, you know. I don't know what those are or what they do. Or anything.
Yeah, what are the Indiana dunes? What were that? Was that some big swath of desert in the middle of Indiana?
Oh well, we still have the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore. See, and it's this place that you protect the environment, and you try to keep everything into the original marshlands, unless like U.S. Steel wants to expand or something. Then it's like, okay, we'll gobble up another 50 acres of this shit. Or 500 acres or something. Oh, no. It's this preserved national lakeshore, but oh, fuck. They want to put in another plate mill or something, you know, or some damn channel or something like that, you know. This is a hot water discharge. It'll kill everything for the next 300 miles, but, you know, it's the national lakeshore and all.
Right.
So what it is, it's a crock of shit. That's what it is, Paul Corman Roberts.
Well, that happens. That happens sometimes. Was that some initiative spearheaded by? You know, I used to fundraise for the Hoosier Environmental Council way back in the day. Way back in the day, I used to call people in Indiana to ask them for money.
You got to be kidding me!
I'm not kidding you.
That from a cubicle in the Bay Area somewhere?
I was doing that from a cubicle in the Bay Area. You better believe I was, because we offered a better rate. We got a better return.
You got to be kidding me. So this is some kind of left-wing Bay Area conspiracy to suck in the hardworking people of Indiana to saving the dunes.
If it makes you feel any better, that phone bank went out of business in 1996, and I don't know where the Hoosier Environmental Council has gone for their outsourced telemarketing since that time.
Well,
so maybe they brought it back home. Maybe, you know, it's, but you should, you know.
Well, here's what we did, Paul Corman Roberts. I'll tell you what we did. We took it out of the hands of the left-wing, left-coast, communistic, telemarketing, non-for-profit, Bay Area anarchist syndicate. And what syndicalism, and what we did is we gave
Don't forget
them,
the occupiers.
Right, the occupiers, and we put
Those
it back
two.
In
Don't
the hands them. Of the
Hell
board
angels.
Of executives of U.S. Steel to manage and shepherd our natural environment. What is good for business
fine,
is good for
fine
the environment.
Fine stewards, they are.
Yeah, they are stewards of the environment. And if you think
That's,
for
when
a minute...
When I think of U.S. Steel, I think of environmental stewardship.
See, Lynn Alexander knows.
She's a communist.
I get
who's
it.
A communist?
No, I get it.
No, she's more of an anarchist, really. Lynn's more of an anarchist. Lynn.
What do you mean?
I probably shouldn't talk about past political affiliations, which may or may not be controversial to some people. I made those telemarketing calls from a hotbed of communism. I cannot deny that. That's, you know, we conspired after we had lots of gay sex, before our meetings, before we had telemarketing. We then did a lot of drugs. We then went over our scripts and how we would
Bilking.
Extort money from the people of Indiana at that point.
Yeah,
but bilking in huge amounts, like udders stuck to cows and just pouring it out into buckets of money, just filling up in our troughs. I swear. By the way, for the record, as of the 2010 federal census, the population of Albuquerque is 545,852. Just thought I'd share that with our guests and listeners out there. Although we don't have any more listeners, we're in archive time now.
Oh, I'm sorry about that, but I was right about the 500. And the thing is, the Progressive Labor Party will never get its grubby hands again on the natural environment and the inhabitants of Northwest Indiana. I will say that now.
There's still Lynn a Progressive
Alexander,
Labor Party?
Some kind of,
I didn't know they were still out there.
They are still out there? I don't know, but Lynn Alexander, I feel like I'm kind of, I don't know what happened. I feel like I've been kind of taken advantage of, because you get me into archive time and we start talking about anarchism.
Well, that always happens when I'm on the show. it's a common theme, and it's not that I'm unwilling to talk about it. It's just that, as Frankie can tell you, I can do that at length, and have, and I certainly don't want to, I don't want to deprive Michelle also of the opportunity if she's still there waiting. I thought that if she, this is a new venture, the Citizens for Decent Literature. Which, there have been people who have said, well, isn't that sort of a pompous, because they don't get the joke, they don't get the origin and who the Citizens for Decent Literature were, in fact, because they were censors, they were people that were trying to mitigate, the moral,
right.
The material available, as far as determining what is acceptable to read. So, really the name comes from that tradition and the desire to push back on censorship and those that would perpetuate it. So if Michelle is there, I don't want to put her on the spot, but if she wants to say a couple of words real fast about the press.
She went to bed,
she
man.
She might be sleeping. I mean, I thought maybe she might be sleeping. She might be, it's late for her. She tends to get up early. But, that's the thing, is that this particular chapbook is produced by our press, which we've been working on together. There's an online component and a chapbook component. And, mini zines, broadsides, all kinds of good stuff coming out of there. And the thing is it is called that because it's sort of tongue in cheek. It's meant to remind people of this organization that really they were sort of hell bent on making decisions for the public about what constitutes good reading and what doesn't, and what has, quote, literary merit and value, and what doesn't. And it really consumed with the practice of keeping things out of the hands of their fellow citizens, which...
of course, because it all leads
obvious.
To pornography. It all leads
right.
to pornography, and we know this.
Right. And the thing
I think that's
a
scientific fact.
Censorship, though, is such a slippery slope that, and you know what the thing is there are people who will say, well, we don't have groups like that anymore in the United States. That's a very old, antiquated idea, this idea of groups trying to censor. We don't have that problem anymore. And people would be absolutely wrong to think that, because there are groups rallied around to this day, banning books, controlling the media, controlling your access to things, and, it's still out there. It's still something to be vigilant about, and your freedom to express yourself creatively is still something that you have to stay firm on and not think that that that's a won battle, because it's not. So that's just a little bit of sort of the philosophy, the mindset, the attitude behind this particular print venture. And so, yeah, we're sort of, you know, kind of honored that we had this opportunity when it all came together to put Dinosaur Ditch together, because it all sort of worked out in a, you know, in a pretty good way that this sort of played out like that. So, yeah, we're, you know, I'm sure if she was available and not sleeping, that's probably something along the lines of what she would have said, that it was a labor of love to put this together, to silk screen each cover, have them hanging around her house to dry. And, yeah, and she did a very good job with it.
All this time I thought I just created decent literature, you know. I didn't know there was all this type of... Well,
it's been given the Citizens for Decent Literature stamp of approval, so it's officially decent.
Right. Well, you know, I say that because you'd be surprised how many people say, "Well, what are you trying to say, that you're the judge of what's decent?" I'm like, no. See, you're not really getting it. You know, you should Google what this particular committee and these activists were about, and you know, they have videos, they have propaganda, you know, and you know, it's something worth learning about, because it is something significant to our history and the history of many other countries. You know, this idea of people, like I said, rallied around controlling your access. I mean, it's kind of a terrible thing. So
that's right.
Yeah, they
pornography
is real.
Means the Sharia law, or vice versa.
Right, because, you know, you get your hands on something that, you know, that doesn't have literary merit, and, you know, the whole world crashes down, you know.
Well, the next thing you know, you're getting turned on and masturbating.
Yeah, well, you know what happens there.
Think about turning the pages of Frankie Metro's latest chapbook with one hand, you know, and you're going to...
Right.
It's hard with that police tape wrapped around it. They got to cut through that.
Yeah, I'm glad that worked out well. I mean,
it looked nice.
It should be a
sharp. It was very sharp.
How do people get a hold of this? I mean, if anybody's going to listen to the archive, how do people get this book?
Yeah, I think, I'm not sure, like, I guess she's, yeah, I think we've lost her for the evening, and that's cool, we'll let her rest. But yeah, there's actually, it is a project of the Literary Underground, but it does have its own section. So, you know, you could do a search for the press, Citizens for Decent Literature, and then, you know, and do the press part of it. There is a press page, and on that page you can order it with PayPal, you can send cash, you know, whatever. I mean, you know, and get a hold of her. You know, and honestly, another good way to do it is to get a hold of myself or Michelle or Paul. I know has some copies on the other coast. And, you know, we could also do it that way. You know, just get a hold of us. But, you know, you can definitely get to it online by going to the press page, you know, which is citizensfordecentliterature.com. So, you know, she's got it. You know, she sort of got it pretty well. It's sort of a kind of, I call it a rabbit hole of all these different pages, and, you know, not that I'm one to talk with my own sites, but, you know, there are a lot of things, a lot of different, there are, you know, roll your own stories, there's the print version, the online version, so, you know, you want to go to the press page, so that's where it is.
That's where you find it, ladies and gentlemen.
One of these days,
I'm going to get my own copy.
Yeah, one of them.
One of what?
You're gonna have them. I guarantee, Tim, you will have them next week. And I do apologize for the delay there. I didn't realize that you were to receive 10. I was informed promptly this week that Tim needs to have 10 copies of his book, and I'm like, okay, you know what? I'll just send those right out to him. So I have them in a package.
I threw in a few
little extras. There's a few little more fun things in there for you.
Yeah,
propaganda from the festival we just had.
Slip them a bone folder.
Slip them a bone folder.
When you guys say bone folder, I get tingly inside.
Yeah, I don't. I kind of feel weird about that.
That disturbs me because I carry them around in my bag.
Well, the thing is, ladies and gentlemen, the the actual book, the reason why the author doesn't have this copy is because the release was supposed to be at this Beast Crawl, Zyfez, Oakland type of thing.
Right.
And when my side
right.
of this fell through, then they all wound up on the left coast, and I wasn't there to save them. And so now I guess they'll be distroed out of the left coast.
Yeah. What we'll try to do is I'll try to scrub any sort of leftist particles. The scent of marijuana might be lingering on them. I'll see if I can get that removed or bleached out, and we'll get those in tip top shape and out right out to you, Tim. I promise.
Thank you so much. You know, free markets and decent literature.
That's right. That's right. They go together. Two great tastes that taste great together.
Right, and when you do have them in your possession, I imagine that people could go through you directly as well, and I think we're, like I said, there are a lot of different events in the works. I mean, it's there are going to be opportunities where you can, definitely read from it, have it available, sort of peddle it in person, as they say,
And ladies and gentlemen, if you're listening to this in the archive, I will have, 10 copies or something, of which maybe half a dozen of those I would like to trade for other chat books if you have them, and if you could write me a note and send it to Post Office Box 1183, Portage, P-O-R-T-A-G-E, Indiana, 46368. Write that down, ladies and gentlemen. Put it in the snail mail. I'm tired of going to the P.O. box, and I'm tired of credit card applications and orders and all these types of things. Yeah, various.
So that's 1183, right? And that's
1183, yes, ma'am.
And that's 46368.
And we can trade chat books. I'll have a few copies of it to trade. That would be fun.
Yay!
All right. I think.
So are you saying right here and now, Tim Murray, that you are going to Albuquerque, New Mexico, in November? You're saying right here and now that you're doing that?
If the good Lord is willing and the creek don't rise, my friend, because I do have with United Airlines, I still have my I couldn't get a refund on my airline ticket. I was going to actually use that refund to buy groceries. Thank you, fucker airline, but the thing is,
I have a credit now
to fly within a year, so I already have the airline ticket part, but it will be up to certain domestic tranquilities, if you will, in order to,
as you said, if the creek don't rise, that damn creek always rises like a mother.
Absolutely.
I caught that.
And I do thank you guys so much for having me on and talking about this dinosaur ditch. I'm glad everybody enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Tim. It's a great book, and it deserves to have a lot of readers.
Thank you so much, Paul and Lynn, and especially Michelle over there. Don't talk too loud, but thank you to Michelle for all the hard work that you put into this book here.
Thank you, and thank you, Frankie Metro. Thank you, Frankie Metro, for getting the board going for us tonight.
Right,
absolutely.
Thank you. I do apologize.
We lost Frankie since we're in archive time, yeah.
Bye, Frankie.
All right.
Thank you, guys. Have a nice evening.
All right, have a great night.
Good night.
We'll see you guys and talk to you guys soon. Bye.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
Thank you.